Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
He is Jim O'Neill. He's formerly chairman of Goldman Sachs Asset Management, and he was appointed also to the UK government as commercial secretary to the Treasury, a role he quit back in September last year. He's also a lifelong fan of Manchester United. I'm trying to give the whole spectrum, Jim. I know a lot of our viewers know you very well, but it's important to not forget any aspect of your life. He joins us now from London. Jim, overall, what struck me in my conversation with Tidjane Thiam is that he's much more confident about the markets in the future. And that seemed to me like one of the reasons why he's going for this capital raising direct to the markets instead of selling off part of the Swiss bank. Would you be so optimistic about the markets overall?
So I certainly think, good morning. I certainly think from a cyclical perspective, all the things that I've kind of follow these days, not quite as closely, of course, as I used to, but I still try to, in terms of the state of the world cycle, all very supportive of the equity rally we're having around the world. Six of the publicly available key ingredients to a global leading indicator and coincident indicator, many of them are at the strongest level since 08, whether it's in the US or elsewhere. So on that basis, it makes a huge amount of sense. The bit which is trickier is, of course, by definition, the higher we go, the less cheap equity markets are. And of course, if the strength of the recovery becomes so powerful that it results in some kind of abrupt shift in monetary policy to an end of QE all over the world, as well as a more accelerated tightening in the US, then our guess is that will be the ultimate challenge. But right now, it looks surprisingly good from a surprisingly large number of different parts of the world.
Right, but are you concerned at all, Jim? And you're absolutely right, and we've been trying to figure out on Surveillance exactly when the real talk about the balance sheet redressing starts. But are you concerned that the markets seem to ignore all geopolitical risks?
You know, I don't really. I have a sort of what seems to be a bit of an unconventional view about this stuff. We've always, you know, we've had geopolitical risk since I first started in this business. I remember many decades ago, flying into Kuwait and arriving there and finding out news that Iraq was launching war on them. And actually, we carried on with a business trip for 2 days, as it happens. But, you know, the idea that geopolitical risk and, for that matter, other uncertainties are new, I just simply don't buy. What is new is that we live in a 24/7 world of media commentary where everybody can comment and is aware of everything. That's the bit that's new, but the fact there's uncertainty isn't new at all.
Jim O'Neill, when your Premier League soccer career was over, you worked for the Swiss Bank Corporation. Folks, this is ancient history now. We're going back 20 years. Jim O'Neill was the research force.
That's when I went down to the Middle East a lot.
Yeah, Jim O'Neill was the research force at Swiss Banking Corporation, which was taken out by UBS, I believe it was in 1998. Jim O'Neill, help me here with a character of Swiss banking, and from where you sit, where does Credit Suisse fit into too big to fail banking? I can't figure out if they're a big bank, a middle bank, a little bank, or a merger candidate. Which is it?
Oh gosh, that's a tough question, because obviously I am 4 years removed from the world of finance, but nonetheless I'm always happy to talk about anything, even if I don't know anything about it. But first of all, the merger was essentially Swiss Bank Corporation taking over UBS.
Excuse me.
And that was a time where both SBC and Credit Suisse were essentially trying to make a very aggressive attempt to become as big globally as the big US guys. For a very brief period, they persuaded themselves they could. And of course, the reality is much of the problems that then followed for the next 20 years, even predating 08, particularly UBS got caught up badly in the 98 mess. They had perpetual problems. And I think to some extent, Credit Suisse still struggles with aspects of the hangover from all of that more than UBS has done. From what I can see, UBS has dealt better with the whole shift into asset management and retaining its preeminence in that, and chosen more carefully to pull away from some of the most unprofitable and most competitive parts of the so-called investment banking business. I think they're still trying to feed the way. But to answer your basic question, they are both very big global banks.
Within the very big global banks, and this is the idea, Jim O'Neill, of we had the merger with Fortis of Belgium and all that. It was a real mass X number of years ago. Can the American banks come in and add value to the European banks? Or is there such a cultural divide that any transactions and combinations with Credit Suisse just are unthinkable across the Atlantic?
So, again, I don't think about this as much as in my higher levels of my last life with at GS, but that said, I do think about it quite a bit. I think the American banks have by and large played an incredibly successful game relative to the big European, globally ambitious players almost across the board for the past 20 years plus. And it's partly because they have dealt better at home with their problems quicker, and it's partly because they deal with the challenges by and large when they come. And my goodness me, as we all know, they come for the big US banks often. They by and large deal with them quicker and more viciously than the Europeans do. I think the other important point I would say, which is relevant to the EU issue tangentially, one of the genuine faults of the EU is that they have never embraced what they claim they would plan to do under the Lisbon agenda and have true cross-services reform. I was reading in the paper this morning the latest tale of nonsense involving Alitalia. In some ways, it's a similar parallel.
Right.
In the banking industry, we have never yet to this date had a truly pan-European leading bank because of the restrictive practices within European countries.
Very good.
And until you get that, you can't really have them competing with the big US guys.
Okay, let's do this. Jim O'Neill, fabulous there on EU banking.
This is Bloomberg Surveillance. I'm Bloomberg Radio. David Gura and Tom Keene in New York. And Tom, you are very excited about our next guest, John Norman, here with us in our Bloomberg 1130 studios.
I am. John Norman is off the London desk of J.P. Morgan, which barely describes the synthesis of derivative and foreign exchange work that J.P. Morgan delivers to Global Wall Street each and every day. John, what are you writing about now? Let me ask an open question to get started. Are you focused on flows into Europe and a resilient euro? Is it the mystery of this election cacophony we're in right now, or is it just the president and the dollar? Which area has your acute interest?
Well, my acute interest is more on Trumponomics and what's left of that program. We're writing on many things right now because it's not the only theme that's in play, but I think the Trump issue is the one that's potentially most material for the market because expectations have been beaten down so much, there's a lot of scope for upside surprise.
It's Greek Wednesday here at Bloomberg Surveillance, so we're allowed to go
into
that. Let's do a little bit of Omega and correlation here and the linkages. Is the 2-10 spread as a proxy for the yield curve, is that linked in some way into the other dynamics of the market, into foreign exchange, into a Swiss and German yields, which have been a little bit fragile recently? What are the correlative impacts right now?
Well, if I had to know one asset price in the world for the next 3 months or 6 months, it wouldn't be the shape of the yield curve. There have been times when the shape of the yield curve was indicative of reflation expectations in the U.S. through stronger growth and higher inflation. But that relationship between the curve and the economy and other financial markets is fairly unstable over time.
What are you looking at right now then if something matters?
I think if you had to look at one indicator right now, it's probably the two-year rate in the States, because that's going to give you some indication of whether, A, the Fed is following through on the dots regardless of what the economy is doing, or whether the broader interest rate structure needs to adjust because Trump is going to deliver on some fiscal ambitions.
Let's take stock of this 100-day mark, even though the president would prefer we not do that. Look at Trumponomics. How fleshed out is it at this point? It was pretty inchoate at the beginning. Do we have a better sense of what it is? And when you look at the market, what are the indications of how well Trumponomics is playing out or not?
Well, we definitely know what it is. What we are learning more about is how difficult almost every aspect of Trumponomics is to implement. So the main components of this have been fiscal stimulus, deregulation, and reordering of the international trade environment. The fiscal stimulus, we suspected, and now I think we have a lot of confirmation, is extremely difficult to push through a divided Washington, and Washington is divided ideologically, even though nominally they're all Republicans. The regulatory side, I think, is the aspect where you can be most hopeful, because that can be affected through executive order, and the president has been unusually active in terms of issuing those since he took office. And all of those have basically instructed government agencies to spend the next 3 months, 4 months, 6 months reassessing the regulations inherited from President Obama. So there I would be fairly hopeful that something can change, but it's a long-term process. And the trade side, we're learning is that there are a lot of constituencies in the U.S. economy, in the corporate sector, and in Washington who just never shared Trump's view of what's wrong with that international system. So you're ending up with a Trumponomics which is much diluted from what we heard on the campaign trail, but there's still some things on the pipeline, particularly on the regulatory side, which I think can be material for markets.
A core aspect of this seems to be a currency policy, certainly something he talked about on the campaign trail, but we have had jawboning from the Treasury Secretary, as is his right and want, and the president as well. How much has that upended things? Hearing from the president before we heard from the Treasury Secretary and getting this semiannual FX report. In your world, how did that ring out?
In my world, I don't really pay much attention to the idea of a U.S. currency policy, because the U.S. has a floating exchange rate. So unless you consider a laissez-faire policy to be a policy, there's not much for the U.S. to talk about, and there hasn't been much to talk about even when Rubin was the Treasury Secretary and the U.S. had a strong dollar policy, allegedly.
No, continue, please.
So it's a bit of a policy fiction. So to hear a focus on it, whether it's a focus from the Treasury Secretary or the President, is not very meaningful to me, except for intraday volatility. Mm-hmm. Because there's no government practice that enforces a level of the exchange rate. So there's nothing to really be recast or jettisoned in order to move the dollar lower.
And now we go theoretical. You mentioned Mr. Rubin. Long ago and far away, he worked for another firm on the street. I can't remember which one it was. And Secretary Rubin came up with a phrase that redefined modern probability theory, likelihood. Can guys like you in the trenches develop intelligent likelihood now, given the lack of the reality of low volatility? If it's this sluggish, this leaden out there, do your probability guesstimates go out the window?
Well, I think that's actually the dirty secret of most Wall Street analysis, is that it's not really about precision and point estimates. It's about likelihood and risk bias.
Thank you. So, right, folks, what you just heard there is the gospel of surveillance. Continue.
So when you say, can we be confident around the bias of a market or the likelihood of a market? I think you can be when markets seem strangely priced. And there are some strange pricings in the market now. One of them is the flatness of the U.S. money market curve. That has ripple effects into currencies and commodities. I don't think it quite matters for corporate markets yet. There's another strange pricing on the volatility side where, yes, vol should be low or falling because the macro environment is quite stable, but it probably shouldn't be this low. So my bias is higher yields, higher dollar within the range, and higher vol.
You okay over there?
I'm okay. Yeah, I'm processing.
This is a religious
moment. I'm
still
looking at your Greek figures that you.
It's well, religious. I'm putting out on Twitter now the gospel of Bloomberg surveillance with John St. Norman. We continue now. John Norman with us. This is a treat. He's usually based in London. And hey, when you come over, do you bring a suitcase of sterling for Mr. Diamond? do you have to bring foreign exchange over? something to meet with the brass?
I don't think he needs that for me.
Okay, I want to get you in trouble here, seriously. There's a lot of, you are a London veteran, and I don't want you to get in trouble with Mr. Diamond and General Counsel. How do you frame the idea of moving talent to other parts of Europe from London? I understand staff, but what about brain power like you? Every company has X number of John Normans that are in London. Their kids are in school there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is that going to stay in London from where you sit without getting you in trouble with J.P. Morgan staff?
Well, I think the whole Brexit issue is very function specific with respect to banks, meaning it's not really about all banking activities potentially having to be done onshore within the euro area. It's about specific types of banking that might have to be done. And this is why I think, you know, most banks have been reasonably clear that there'll be some share of their activities that move, but it's probably a minority share of their activities. And in any event, I feel like this whole debate has just gotten pushed back a couple of years by the snap election in the UK.
Have you quantified, if Italy leaves the euro, how much the Italian lira will depreciate? Or if Madame Le Pen wins, how much the French franc will depreciate?
He's doing it on a napkin right now.
Have you worked that out on the back of a cocktail napkin?
I've done, so getting back to your issue of risk bias, I've done the analysis on the franc, and I would say the starting point for franc depreciation if France were not in the euro is down 25%. And since Italy is a more extreme version of France with respect to every debt metric, it would probably be 40% down. As a starter.
Are you surprised at the extent to which this wasn't discussed during the campaign leading up to the first round of the French election? It didn't seem like the economics of a Frexit were front and center.
I guess it's not surprising that economics often gets short shrift during a political campaign. What is interesting is that Le Pen is now publicly acknowledging that perhaps French savers might be disadvantaged by a Frexit. Mm-hmm. So somehow the memos have kind of circulated within the campaign community that maybe Frexit is not a win-win and it's potentially a lose-lose and lose big time.
Going from Frexit to Brexit once again, I mean, is this debate
Frexit
over clearing something that's going to pick up steam as we move forward here? Is that going to be a bigger issue for folks in London? Calls from France that clearing be moved out of London?
Yes, because that is a function that's being seen as necessary to be performed onshore. But that also means that banks where the majority of employees are not involved in that activity would be staying in London. So there's a reason why all of this talent is concentrated in one place. There's a synergy, and so I think banks would only move the de minimis number of people required to comply with new regulations. But it just seems like that regulatory environment may not take shape for a few years.
In the time we've got left with you, help me here with Canada. In your voluminous research report, you do speak of Canada. I was thunderstruck at the weakness of Canadian dollar over the last couple months, and I guess there's oil and there's this, that, and the other thing. Is there an opportunity for our listeners with Canada with a trade talk going on? Is it even feasible to be weaker from 135 to 141?
It is, simply because I feel like the big driver over the next 6 to 12 months is going to be Fed hiking, Bank of Canada doing nothing. And since that is not priced into bonds, it's not
higher rate in the U.S., big money flows to the U.S.
I think so. I look at the trade issue as a bit of a sideshow because I don't think the U.S. is looking at Canada as a structural problem for the U.S. Canada is one of the U.S.'s largest trading partners if you add exports and imports. But if you net those, Canada is a very minor contributor to the U.S.'s overall trade deficit.
Does the President of the United States know what you just said?
I think
Tom will tweet at him right now.
I think they're likely. Sure. I think they're presidential
John's
advisors who are aware
back.
Of this.
let me ask you while we're on the subject of the Fed. Do you expect the same rhetoric about data drivenness to prevail when we talk about winding down the balance sheet? In other words, are you able to apply pure data to that process, or in this uncharted territory, is it something new that requires a bit of gut instinct as well?
Well, if you think of shrinking the balance sheet is just another way to tighten monetary policy, then the same kind of principles that have led the Fed to raise short-term rates would be the same ones that determine the pace at which it will let the balance sheet roll off. I think what is going to get more interesting is the inability of anyone to really calibrate how changes in the balance sheet affect interest rates, because we've never seen that process in motion before. So that's where the uncertainty comes. And there's another element of uncertainty that will come next year when the composition of the Fed is different, and we have to see whether or not this kind of autopilot runoff strategy that we presume Yellen will put in place end of this year is going to be maintained in 2018.
Again, based on presumption here, reports that Randy Quarles will be this new regulatory head at the Fed. Does that tell us anything about the personality composition of this new Fed, or is that really sort of an outlying character on the Board of Governors?
I think it's a bit early to tell.
Yeah.
And importantly, there are as many as 5 seats, you know, up for grabs. So it's really too early to make a judgment on this. My bias is to say that you will have a more conservative Fed, not necessarily because that's what the president wants, but because these are appointees that have to be Senate approved, and Senate Republicans probably would prefer more conservative policymakers.
Generous of you to spend your morning with us. John Norman is with J.P. Morgan London, joining us in our New York studios this morning. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. There's something new from Bloomberg. It's called Lens. Starting right now, you can use the Bloomberg iOS app off your iPhone or iPad, or our new Google Chrome extension to read any news story on any website, scan it, and then instantly see the news story's relevant market data from Bloomberg. In addition, see all the bios of the key people mentioned in the story. It's called Lens, and it is just that, a lens into the people and the data of any story you may be reading. Again, Lens brings you the power of Bloomberg's news and data. Download our iOS app or search for the Bloomberg extension at the Chrome Store to try Lens out. Learn more at Bloomberg.com/Lens. Bring in the author that we have.
Yeah, we continue to look at this balance here between geopolitical risk, central banking, all of that. Let's bring in James Tavridis, Admiral James Tavridis, now Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, joining us on our phone lines and eager to talk to Admiral Tavridis about what's going on in East Asia, about our policy toward North Korea. But let's begin with Russia, U.S.-Russia relations. Word yesterday from Jason Chaffetz, the soon-to-be former committee chairman, joining us. He said here that Michael Flynn, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, may have violated U.S. law by failing to disclose his business dealings with Russia and Turkey. Obviously, the shadow cast by this continues to encompass the White House and many parts of Washington. James Tavridis, where do we go from here with this investigation into Russian interference in our election?
We've got to follow the facts wherever they lead, as the saying goes, without fear or favor, David. And I'm increasingly concerned that the diffusion pattern of the investigations is increasing, and therefore makes it less likely they'll converge on a set of outcomes. Right now, by my count, there are at least 4 separate investigations in progress. My money is on the FBI. They're pretty relentless. As the saying goes, they always get their man, and I am hopeful that will be the one to focus on in the months ahead.
There are a lot of people here expressing some concern about James Comey's ability to follow this through in light of what happened during the campaign. Do you still have confidence in his ability to do that?
I do. I think that despite the fact that you saw the New York Times articles that talked about the way in which he handled the 2 different investigations, Trump and Clinton, differently, and that undermined some confidence in him, if you really read that material, and if you know Director Comey and his history and background, I think he is someone who tries to keep the ball in the middle of the fairway, and I think he will on this one as well.
I don't think that we've spoken since Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made that trip to Moscow, met with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, and also with the President of Russia as well, Vladimir Putin. What did you observe on that trip? There was the ambiguity about whether or not he would get that meeting with the President of Russia, something that Secretary of State John Kerry had every time that he went to Moscow.
Yeah.
He did end up sitting down with him for about 2 hours, I believe, was reported. What is the Admiral James Tavridis read on U.S.-Russia relations at this point?
Well, on a scale of 0 to 10, where 10 would be Tillerson came out of the meeting and holding hands with Lavrov and Putin's arm around him, and we all decided we were going to bury the hatchet right in the back of Assad, which is what we should be doing. That would be a 10. That would have been a great outcome. Or a 0, which would be the KGB busts the meeting and drags Tillerson away for interrogation. I'd call this about a 3. It was chilly. It was not good atmospheric. The hey, you wait to see the president, and then a 2-hour harangue, as it's been described to me by those who were aware of it. I don't think it was a good meeting, and I don't think it advanced us.
I pity the young ensign that had to go up to the flight deck or whatever it's called at the top of the ship to talk to the captain, to Mr. Stravitas, to get dressed down because something wasn't proper 3-4 below in the engine room. It must have been ugly.
Yeah, we had a few conversations like that.
I'm sure
on
you
my
did.
Ships.
Your book is phenomenal. It's only April, but it's certainly on my short list for Book of the Year. Mr. Larrabee, Eric Larrabee, writing on FDR, Commander-in-Chief, FDR, his lieutenants and their war. Does Mr. Trump have any lieutenants? Is he a commander-in-chief, or is his dysfunction so great that there's no hope of a marshal, a king, or a Nimitz?
I think we're not going to see a Marshall, a King, or a Nimitz, but I am hopeful that with the departure of Flynn, with the diminution of the role of Steve Bannon, we're seeing perhaps a team of rivals, to go to Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, starting to pull together. I think it's unlikely we'll see that kind of focus that FDR had. And Tom, of course, we need to account for the fact that FDR had the crystallizing effect of a global world war.
Sure, of course.
But in today's world, with so many different elements at play, I think the best we can hope for is a team of rivals type outcome. And I feel it's trending in that direction, to be fair.
I want to get your read on the power that this cabinet has, particularly in the national security arena. There was a lot of complaining about how centralized power was, military power was, security power was in the Obama White House. Has that changed somewhat? So does the cabinet in the White House have more autonomy than in the Obama White House? Do you see the military playing a bigger role perhaps than it did under President Obama?
Enormous change. As a combatant commander myself for 7 years, both at NATO and then before that at U.S. Southern Command, in charge of everything south of the United States, I felt the long arm of the White House frequently grab my shoulder and direct me, and I'd often go back to Secretary Gates and say, hey, I can't do my job. The White House staff is pushing on me. From everything I can see, and I've spoken with General Mattis, General Kelly, that has stopped. This is really a decentralized command and control structure, and that poses other additional challenges, but I think it's a far better way to run a complex global world than the previous, hey, let's run it from D.C. and put the telescoping arm out on you. So I think particularly Secretary Mattis, General Mattis, has a great deal of autonomy, and he'll use it cautiously and judiciously, but well.
Let me turn our attention to North Korea and the time that we have left. Our colleague here, Nick Wadhams, who covers foreign policy for us here at Bloomberg News, did a great piece looking at what the U.S. might do in terms of strikes, what it might be able to do, and what the reaction to that might be. I imagine this is something that you've seen gamed out. This is something that the U.S. military has had to have thought of before. Are we there yet? Have we exhausted most of our options when it comes to sanctions, when it comes to diplomacy?
No, we've not. I think that we're actually just beginning to see new Chinese sanctions bite. We're seeing China willing to play with the new president on this one, and I think that we still have a ways to go on sanctions. Now, we are seeing a lot of saber rattling, and I'll say very salient, the arrival of USS Michigan, an 18,000-ton submarine with 150-plus Tomahawk missiles. We're still rattling those sabers pretty hard, but I think sanctions and diplomacy still have a way to go.
Well, Anna Feifeld in the Washington Post has North Korea conducting live fire artillery drills. Yeah. Help me here with a question every American of a certain vintage has in the back of their mind. We're going to go show the flag over there. Japan's going to show the flag, etc. And all anybody can remember, Admiral Stravitas, is that afternoon when we learned that an Exocet missile shot from a million miles away could hit a British destroyer or whatever off the Falkland Islands. Can they reach us doing our exercises?
They can. However, we have much, much better air defense systems, Tom. Our Aegis anti-ship missile defense system is very, very capable of defending our carriers, our destroyers, our cruisers. Also, recall that we will take out those systems before they're launching at us. So,
how do you do that? How do you do that?
Yeah, we
can you say so without, you know?
I can. A combination of cyber, a combination of our special forces, and our ability to use intelligence and early warning so that we can strike before they strike us. Yeah. In other words, Tom, we want to shoot the archer, not deal with the arrow that's coming in, and we will do that if necessary.
Thank you. Very valuable. Admiral Stavridis, of course, at the Fletcher School with his service within the U.S. Navy, and I really can't say enough about his new book. I've been talking it up, the Leader's Book. What it basically is the admiral, with all his connections, went to 50 people with brass on their shoulders. They got eagles on their shoulders, John Tucker, and stuff like that. And he said, what's a book that matters for you? And it's an eclectic book. David Gurra, it includes Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankees and the
King
Bloomberg
Court,
Surveillance
yeah,
Court, whatever it was.
Just have Dan.
Yeah, it's
on
really,
my shoulder,
really interesting, eclectic set of books, including Michael Schar's Killer Angels about Gettysburg, among others.
Very strong, very strong. Yeah. And a nice read. And you've been reading books from it. I mean, you've taken recommendations.
I've taken the Stavridis Kool-Aid, full disclosure. Right now, Jeffrey Curry joining us. He is with Goldman Sachs, our global head of commodities at research. Jeffrey, let me start right in and go Marshallian with you on supply and demand elasticities. Is the latest drop in oil, is it about supply dynamics or is it about demand dynamics?
I would say the same drivers that pushed us down in March, which were mainly technical. We would argue the back end drove that downdraft in March, and the back end is driving it again, which I think really goes to a broader point that it was probably strategic hedging programs as opposed to anybody trading fundamentals, because I would argue that people who trade fundamentals are wearing thin. They still have their positions there, but their patience wearing thin. We did not see big exodus of the length out of the market, which I think is an indication that this was really more of black box trading, and the driver of it was selling on the back end.
What's the visible OPEC Russia-U.S. dynamic now? Forget about the black box. What is the dynamics of supply and demand you will watch as we stay at 50 and as we go forward into the summer?
Well, if you look at the fundamental scorecard, it is still supportive of higher prices in inventory draws. But the fact of the matter is you have not seen the inventory draws in the U.S. data, which we believe will be the last place you see it, is why the patience is beginning to wear thin. Now, in terms of the fundamentals, three things we're watching. One, global demand. And this really is a global demand story as we go into the second half of the business cycle. The survey data that came out in first quarter was gangbusters. The markets need to see it transition into strong hard data and commodity demand. China's demand data that came out last week for the macro, very strong. So that's first. Second, we're watching is low-cost producers cutting production. OPEC and Russia, again, on the scorecard, that looks relatively positive, that they have actually implemented the cuts in more than what we had anticipated. Then the third issue is the shale response. At this point, yes, we believe there's going to be a big shale response at the end of this year. We have a takeout of 850,000 barrels per day, but we're not there yet. The inventory draws are a second quarter phenomena. We're still confident they're going to happen.
Looking at these headlines crossing about Steve Mnuchin speaking at an event, I think convened by The Hill in Washington, D.C., talking about this tax proposal that's going to be unveiled today at the White House. How much does that affect your world? How much does that affect the commodities world? What we get from the White House? What happens with tax reform?
I would argue that the big issue is the potential for a border adjustment tax on commodities. For us, we're watching three things. First is, I think it's important to remember tax cuts are a lot easier than tax reform. In fact, in the messages that he just came out and said, the focus was on that 15% corporate tax rate. The one issue about the administration is they've been very clear that they're not supportive of a strong dollar, which means there's a probability they back away from that border adjustment tax, which then really takes the impact on commodities down a notch, because that was the potential for it to create a big rise in WTI and gasoline prices in the U.S. The second issue is that we're still short on details, which means that this thing could get pushed out quite a bit. But the third and most important point is the market doesn't have a lot of confidence of anything real positive coming out of this. So if you do see some positive event, it could put a lot of downward pressure on markets such as gold.
Ask you a question about gold. We see gold here at 1265 right now. I mean, we've seen it go down since the French election. How much of movement in gold right now is attributable to political risk versus, say, ETF flows?
I would say political risk needs to be divided into political risks such as a lack of confidence in the administration pushing through anything real positive, and then geopolitical risks such as North Korea or Syria. Obviously, the North Korea and Syria, there's something embedded in there, but it's not a lot. Mm. I like to point out, everybody's calling me about gold. Gold, as you pointed out, 1265, yeah. That's not that interesting. Gold vol at 9%, which tells you the rest of the markets are even more boring than what's going on in gold.
Well, within the boring is the money question, which is where are we in some super cycle, which is a phrase I don't particularly like. But the fact is, we did have a commodity boom that you were part of. We don't blame it on Jeff Curry, but we certainly blame the end of it on Jeff Curry. Wither the next commodity boom, or is it just a lassitude, or even the historic commodity deflation that we knew in our youth?
When we look at long-term oil prices, they were stable at somewhere around $50 to $60 a barrel throughout that downdraft, even when the front end went to 26. Which really underscores that the market is finding a new point of mean reversion somewhere around, let's say, $50 to $55 a barrel on oil. That normalization is an indication that the market now has confidence that shale is the dominant resource base, the dominant technology. So all we're arguing right now is the cost of extracting shale. It can go below, it can go above.
What's
that 50-55. We've seen enough of the earnings reports out of the companies to put a number somewhere in that $50 to $55 a barrel. But the risks are that that's beginning to drift down. And, you know, if you use the 90s as an example, because you think about super cycles, we've had three. Yep. One was in the 1950s, the other one was the 70s, and the other one was in the 2000s. Yes, you could argue there are about new demand growth, Western Europe and the first one, Japan, and then China. But the real super cycle driver was technology. It was offshore in the 50s, deep water in the 70s, shale in 2000. Those periods in between, once you knew the technology, were characterized by stable long-term prices for commodities. That's the type of environment.
So does that technology continue with an inertial force that keeps us at 50 a barrel, or is the real thing we should be talking about quickly here, Jeff, is a new technology coming on?
Again, if we use the 80s and 90s as an example of this, we were confident that the long-term oil price was $20 a barrel over time, but it didn't stop the market from going as low as 10 on the bottom and as high as 40 on the top, but the back end remained anchored somewhere around 20. So in terms of thinking about, you know, your technology, they're going to get better at shale, but it's going to be offset by inflationary pressures, okay, which is why you stayed at $20 a barrel over that time period.
Okay. John Tucker, do you have any more questions on, like, your drive-in and your Hummer H2?
Gas prices.
Yeah, how much am I going to pay for gas? Let's get down to brass tacks.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Our near-term target for 2Q is $57.50 on TI, $59 on Brent, which really means we're going to go into a trading range of somewhere between $55 and $60. We've been in this, let's call it $50, dropping down in the $49. Okay. To even 47, but it's a 10% up move.
Jeff, we didn't care about the price of oil. We wanted to know about the tolls in New Jersey.
Yes.
Jeff Curry, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for
having me. With Goldman Sachs. Greatly appreciate it this morning. Michael Mayo with us, who has put a shingle out at a number of Wall Street firms. Right now, shingles out at home where they say, stop working so hard. Michael Mayo on the banks. I want to go to Citigroup in what I think is the most interesting chairman-CEO dialectic, maybe that's the right word, dynamic, in banking. We've got a guy with a degree in Eastern civilization, Michael O'Neill, dealing with a really, really good football player from Harvard in Mr. Corbett. Is it oil and water? Do they get along? And when are the two of them going to get together to make this 10-for-1 reverse split dog move?
You sound like some of the investors at the Citigroup annual meeting.
Thank you. I don't own shares. Full disclosure.
Look, the reason I go to annual meetings, the reason I went to the Citigroup annual meeting as a Wall Street analyst who advises institutional investors is it's the only chance, the once-a-year chance, to ask questions of Mike O'Neill, the chairman, and other directors, and have them be held publicly accountable. It's also the only chance I can see both Mikes at Citigroup, the chairman and the CEO, interact. And they definitely interact well. You know, job of the chairman is to oversee management, but I don't want them to get along too well. And that's another reason I went to the meeting yesterday. Citigroup has certainly made progress. You know, the downsizing they've done with the Citi holdings, that was the bad assets, that's equal to divesting the fifth and sixth largest U.S. banks combined. They've come a long way. They've improved the balance sheet to one of the strongest levels that it's ever been. Having said that, the returns are still subpar.
Yeah. And I want to make clear, David, a surveillance correction. I said Eastern Civilization. Michael O'Neill's degree is in European civilization. But, David, what's important here is Mr. O'Neill, as senior as he is, enjoyed working at Continental Illinois. He knows what a bad workout looks like.
What happens, Mike Mayo, after he leaves? Is this a sort of bifurcated system of governance that could change yet again? Could we see these roles combined going forward?
Well, that was one of my questions yesterday. And the chairman of Citigroup yesterday said he has 2 years left and he's leaving. And he also said once he leaves Citigroup, all options are on the table. So Citigroup right now is a separate chairman and CEO. He said it's possible. He didn't say probable, but possible. They have one person take both roles. And it was interesting. He said, you know, giving someone the chairman role is not a reward or punishment. It's just what's best at that particular time.
We were talking with Chris Ailman of CalSTRS a little while ago, and they had a presence at the Wells Fargo meeting yesterday. Let me ask just a broad question about how you approach these annual meetings. It's an opportunity to ask questions. Yesterday was an opportunity at the Wells Fargo meeting for CalSTRS to advocate for some change to the board there. What do you hope to get out of it? What is your approach? Answers to questions? How do you carry that forward after the meeting takes place?
Well, I think your key word in your question is advocate. What am I personally advocating for? I'm at annual meetings, and I'm unique among people dealing with institutional investors. I don't usually see anyone else there, and sometimes I'm asking 9 of the 10 questions. But what I'm advocating is not on behalf of the customers or the employees or the public interest or a lot of other matters that are very important, whether it's climate change or board diversity. I'm there to advocate for one stakeholder and one stakeholder alone, and that's the shareholder. And so I want to know, instead of having a check-the-box exercise, and that happens at most annual meetings, I want to talk about matters of substance. So that's strategy, business mix, capital allocation, the major risks, the things that will drive long-term shareholder value.
To that point, and Francine Lacroix with her important Credit Suisse interview today, people are confronting the strategy of it ain't working. Is the tone at Citigroup, like at Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank with earnings tomorrow, it ain't working, or is Citigroup saying, no, it is working, and we just need more time? Which is it?
Well, I'd say my reaction to Citigroup annual meeting is sweet and sour. Mm. So the sweet part, and by the way, they had good food there yesterday for
there was
the sweet.
A buffet. Good.
And you know, to buy one share of Citigroup stock at $60, you can go to the annual meeting and get bread pudding, pumpkin muffins, peach apricot pastries, and the works.
But John Tucker calling his broker right now.
Yeah, let's go.
But the sweet part is the restructuring that they've done. And so, you know, they've come a long way. Their market share in capital markets is the best that it's been since the financial crisis. They've made progress on the wholesale side. On the consumer side, they've divested many businesses, Argentina, Brazil, Colombia. And on the regulatory side, they're the only one of the 8 large banks that got a clean bill of health on the first round of the living will. So that's all positive. And also the chairman, for the first time yesterday, thought Citigroup can get their 2019 targets. The sour side of this, though, Tom, and as you brought up, Mike O'Neill, he is the bank restructuring guru. He's the chairman. He agreed with the CEO saying the restructuring is done. And I'm not sure why the restructuring is done when they have such subpar returns, worst in class stock market valuation. And by their own words, they're not fully optimized. So I think they might need a restructuring 2.0.
David, I would point out that the shares are trading where they were in 1995. Now, that's not in the land of the great Walter Wriston, but that's 22 years ago.
When you look at the earnings season thus far, we get Deutsche Bank earnings tomorrow. That's another animal in the menagerie of bank earnings. But let me ask you sort of what we're seeing shape up as the trends here, particularly when you look at the role Wall Street is playing and the role that Main Street is playing in banking.
Well, I'd say when I look at the bank earnings for the first quarter, U.S. bank earnings, the winners were Wall Street activities, real economy clients. So if you look at the Wall Street activities, they're leading over Main Street. And most of the large banks beat numbers due to capital market activity. So that's fixed income trading, equity trading, underwriting. And those were up 1/5 both year-over-year and quarter-over-quarter. That was good. On the other hand, loans had their traditional loans had their worst quarter in 6 years. So what you saw is a degree of a substitution effect, less corporates going to traditional bank loans and more going to the capital markets.
Quickly here, do you have an opinion on Credit Suisse, on how they will be placed into a better place?
With the Credit Suisse capital raise today, I have a general comment on European banks.
Please.
The U.S. banks raised capital in 2009, and the European banks are starting to raise a lot more capital now. So 8 years later, better late than never. Having said that, you know, the Swiss banks traditionally have some of the highest capital ratios in the world on some measures, but on the traditional kind of equity-to-asset ratio, it's still far below the U.S. banks.
You were legendary at that shop. Do you feel there's such a Swiss imperative that the Swiss government will say, no, Credit Suisse is this important to Switzerland, and this is the way we're going to do it?
Well, I think, you know, we talk about too big to fail in the United States.
It's nothing like Switzerland.
A lot more, you know, germane to the foundation, the country that it is, the U.S.
You see that look that he's given me, David?
Yeah, I tried not to make eye contact on you.
Today? Michael Mayo, thank you so much. Glad to make your morning miserable. He's an independent bank analyst, but of great substance, and we look forward to his next business. Is he? Maybe he's retired.
More trouble, Thomas.
Is it John Tucker?
And as long as they keep serving breakfast at those annual meetings.
Meetings, they'll keep going. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.